Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Rare Disease Podcast for Medic. And a happy new year to everyone who is listening. 2024, here we come. And today, as a new year's gift to show you how much we love you, we are bringing you a one-off special of this podcast with one of our fantastic ambassadors. Hope Russell-Winter is a singer-songwriter, and she was diagnosed with multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1 at 13 years old and is managing a number of tumors at the moment, which is something was brought to light while she was recently recording for The Voice UK. She's pursuing an active career in the music industry while doing many other things, and we're so lucky to have her on our ambassador program. She recently made it to the finals of Voice UK and has accumulated over 20 million hits and 100,000 subscribers on her YouTube channel. So, welcome, Hope Russell-Winter.
Thanks for having me.
Well, look, you're a celebrity, so we're very grateful to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be on the show.
So, we're going to get into your recent rise to Voice UK fame, but before we do, we just want to get to know you a bit. So, I got to hear about you a lot. I got to hear about you a lot through one certain person. Can we give the game away who it is?
Yeah, of course.
You're related to someone famous, aren't you?
Famous in the medics world.
Yeah, in the rare world. This young lady here is in fact the daughter of Kim Winter.
Legends.
Legend extraordinaire. And so Hope has been someone in my mind for a long time because, like all proud mums, your mum talks about you a lot and your brother. But I was so glad that you became an ambassador for Medics for Rare Diseases. So do you mind telling us a little bit about what MEN1 is for those who don't know?
Yeah, so MEN1 stands for multiple endocrine neoplasia disorder type 1, which is a little bit of a mouthful of a condition to say. Yeah, so I was diagnosed when I was 13, and MEN basically in short means that you're prone to getting tumors within your endocrine system. So that'd be your pituitary gland, your adrenal glands, and your pancreas, sometimes in rare occasions, other places. And that basically affects everybody who has MEN quite differently. So for me, I've been really over the course of my kind of my teenage years and my adult life so far, I've been, touch wood, relatively lucky in terms of how severe MEN can get. So I manage a couple of tumors. I've got a prolactinoma, so that's a tumor in my pituitary gland, and a couple of little guys just hanging out near my pancreas. And at the moment they're both pretty stable. In my sort of early teenage years, my prolactinoma was a little bit bigger, and that meant that I had secondary Addison's, which is when you're essentially cortisol deficient. Some people are just genetically cortisol
Yeah.
deficient, but I was
It was
cortisol
because of the
tumor. So then I took some medication called cabergoline, which I now take every 2 weeks, which is such a random amount of time. It's like the tiniest little pill every 2 weeks. And that basically meant that my tumor shrunk from 3 centimeters, which sounds tiny, but in the sort of tumor world is not ideal, to just under 0.5 millimeters. So it's like,
Yeah, wow.
so now none of my hormones are really affected that much by it at all. But yeah, there was a funny period during my teenage years where I was completely cortisol deficient, so I had to take cortisol 3 times a day, and I did my DOV, and all my friends had to be trained in how to give me a cortisol injection and things like that. So yeah, so in a nutshell, MEN, although it's sort of simple to describe in terms of how it can affect you, there are a myriad of different ways that it can affect every person who has it, and it's a little bit of an unpredictable condition, and it's also a lifelong condition as well. And my brother and I share the same condition, but to demonstrate that, my brother's had a really different experience with MEN to me, so it can really
Yeah,
vary.
I was going to say that, your brother's older than you, isn't he? Shout
Yeah,
out to Joel.
shout out Joel, love ya.
Love you, Joel.
Yeah,
also rise to fame through The Voice UK and all his
Oh
like
my
talking
God, the
heads.
fans, they loved him. They
The
all found
Joel
him as
fans.
well. They just absolutely, the camera loves him. He was a natural. I knew he'd be a natural on camera, but yeah, so he's 4 years older than me. So when I was 13 when we got diagnosed, he was 17. So quite pivotal ages, you know, really, really different ages to be diagnosed. And also in terms of our healthcare at that time, you know, he had to go straight into adult services basically because he was just on the cusp of being 18. So that was straight into sort of adult healthcare, which is so different to, you know, children's healthcare. I was at Great Ormond Street when I first got diagnosed, and I had a really, really positive experience, and I was really, really looked after. And he had a different experience, and it's really hard at 17 going into sort of adult healthcare straight away. And yeah, and then he basically had tumors in his pancreas that developed, and then he ended up having a Whipple surgery when he was 21. So
Yeah,
very, very different experience.
a major operation at a very
Major
young age. Yeah.
surgery, yeah, which he is almost well, he's basically completely recovered from. He's got a half a chunk of his pancreas out and no gallbladder and things like that, but he's, you know, looking at him, you'd never know.
Never know. Yeah.
So
Yeah. And is the aim basically to make sure that none of these tumors develop into something sinister like a cancer? Is that what the obviously symptomatic treatment's important? Like, you know, if you're not making enough cortisol, then we want to prevent that. But is there also that risk?
yeah, so there's the risk essentially that you can develop these net cancers. So the neuroendocrine the tumors can become malignant, I guess is the right word. So we have regular monitoring every sort of 6 months to a year. So we have MRIs and blood tests just to check that nothing new has grown or the tumors that we've already got haven't got excited and grown and you know become cancerous essentially. So it's kind of a two-part condition because you're probably managing at some point over the course of your life some tumors that may give you symptoms and may affect your health or particularly your hormones because your endocrine system is so linked to your hormonal health. So it's partly that, and it's also partly, I guess, prevention of, you know, really
Yeah,
getting to a
the
cancer.
long term.
Yeah, and that's
Yeah.
what's been so brilliant even in the last sort of 10 to 15 years of healthcare. Obviously healthcare is so, it can just change and evolve so quickly compared to people that had MEN 50 years ago that may have a really late diagnosis in their, you know, when they're 50 plus, you know, things are much harder to control once they get further on. So now even the more light that's shed on it as a condition and the more the symptoms can be linked to a diagnosis, and the earlier you get that diagnosis, the more likely you are to, you know, hopefully have a relatively stable life with the condition, which I suppose is the same for lots of other rare conditions. You know, as soon as you get that
Exactly.
diagnosis, it's about that preventative healthcare, really.
Yeah. I had the honor of working with Rare Minds, so mostly Kim, Hope's mum, on the mental health and rare disease module that Medics for Rare Diseases put out last year. And obviously, originally, we had always wanted to do a big piece on mental health within rare disease, because within Rare Disease 101, but it became clear that that was such a big topic, we couldn't do it justice in this, like, you know, small snapshot thing. So we always knew we were coming back to it. And I have to say that work with Kim has really, really helped develop my understanding and our thoughts on what it is healthcare professionals can do for people living with rare conditions. I think something like MEN is a really good example of one of those conditions that actually it's going to be the long term, day in, day out interactions, management, and care that is going to make a really big difference, because you've got a whole life to lead. You've got lots of things to do, as we're going to hear about later. and how can you be as healthy as you can be, and making sure that the MEN doesn't develop anywhere into something that that would give you a worse outcome.
Yeah, and I think that's such a great part of the work that Kim does. So for those who don't know, my mum is the founder of a charity called Rare Minds, which looks after the mental health of patients and also patients' families that have been diagnosed with rare conditions. And I think that's a really key part of the work that she does that I think sometimes can get really overlooked by the NHS, and that's not necessarily the NHS's fault. Obviously they're working at max capacity, all the time. But the things like the mental health effects and the sort of the long-term management of living with a rare condition that's also really unpredictable, and you're not in control of it really, aside from trying to live as a healthier life as possible. Sometimes it's just bad luck, and you deal with things, and they might pop up, they might not. And I think that's a really key part of what Rare Minds is so good at looking at, is the kind of management of the anxiety that can bring up, and whatever mental health struggle that might bring up for each individual patient, which is really, really overlooked, I think. And especially within, we've talked about this before, that the fact that rare diseases or rare conditions are even really overlooked within the medical world, the fact that there isn't a kind of separate module in terms of the education for it. And that's a really, even if the actual health side of it and the knowledge about the conditions themselves, then the mental health is going to be down the priority list
Oh yeah,
even
fast.
further.
In reality, I think working with Kim and Rare Minds really brought to me the, she was always going on about uncertainty. And obviously I knew the idea, uncertainty is a big deal in rare disease. Of course it is, because of the lack of information and things, but and I understand about lack of prognosis and what you're gonna have. But really, I think that work drummed it home, that day in, day out, living with the uncertainty, macro uncertainties of, how healthy are you going to be in how many years' time, versus is this appointment going to happen today because the last one was cancelled. So macro versus micro uncertainties, and the toll that can take on someone's mental health. And I think with COVID, something that's been quite useful when we're educating about this is we can go, think about COVID. How did you feel with, how did you deal with uncertainty then? What kind of feelings did it provoke for you? How did it impact your mental health? And now think about that on a really chronic, lifelong basis. And that's really helped us describe that. Because otherwise, say MEN, that is definitely a condition that I think the average medical student or someone coming out of medical school recently will have heard about. They could probably, talk a little bit about it. But I think probably then it would go into the genetics of MEN or something like that, rather than what it would be like to be a 23-year-old woman living with this and getting on with their lives and their hopes and their dreams and what the needs are there.
And I also think that there can be a tendency within, I guess, because I'd feel the same if I was a medical student, and I'd be interested in those really kind of very interesting cases that are also, I guess, the sort of worst case scenarios. And I think often, like, in terms of the medical world, it can get caught up with MEN of like, here's one of the rarest, worst cancers that happened, and this huge surgery that's life-changing. And obviously that is a part of a lot of people that experience, my brother had a very similar experience. And that is a very valid part of it. But I also sometimes think that that is not a simpler thing with mental health, but it's a very actionable, here's a surgery, here's a cancer, here's a surgery solution, and then this is the plan post-surgery to deal with the after effects of what that can provide, and then you're good to go. Obviously not good to, obviously that will have a long-term effect on you, but I think it's sometimes easier to get caught up in more obvious, really big impact things, rather than the impact of lots of smaller things that have
the building.
Have a less clear sort of mental health impact over a long amount of time. And I think that's obviously I would feel the same if I worked in health and I was interested in the most interesting cases that there are. But I think that it's often the mundane actually that's sometimes harder to deal with because it's just long term, you know, uncertainty, which is sometimes just as hard as a really big, big event.
And I also think for young people, we're not necessarily set up to do long-term conditions. It's something I talk about quite a lot with rare disease. And people think of it in terms of just transition of care, often talking about moving from pediatric to adult services. And my feeling with that is, I don't think it's the transition necessarily. Yeah, transitions probably can be better, but generally it's because there aren't those long-term services for young people who don't fall into adolescence or don't fall into children's care. And then I think this is just a prime example of that, because this is while it's the endocrine system, obviously the symptoms, right, can affect a large number of systems. And so you're a young person with a chronic condition who's then going to be spread across the NHS. And we don't necessarily have a place for young people like that. I can imagine that Joel at 17 found himself to always be the youngest person on a ward or in an inpatient place. And I think someone once said, I think it was Tilly Rose once said that someone says, oh, don't you just get used to it though? The sort of, if you're experiencing the same thing over and over again. And she said, well, no, if you stick me with a needle once, it hurts. But if you keep sticking me with a needle in the same place over and over again, it starts to really impact you, and always being the person, the odd one out, I guess, or feeling like you don't fit within the services. That's hard, especially as I think a young adult.
I think that's so true. And that sort of that gap between sort of mid-teen to early adult, I think there is such a gap in healthcare. I remember when I was at Great Ormond Street, it was amazing healthcare and I felt very looked after, but it was also geared towards much younger children. So the facilities that are around, and also I was, weirdly, I was going from the oldest in pediatric care to then being the youngest in adult services. And that was a really strange transition, because you sort of get, you're going from being weirdly not babied, but you're around that sort of culture.
Yeah, it's like going from primary school to secondary school, right? You know, when you see kids at the top of primary school, you're like, oh, you look really out of place. Yeah. But then when you see them in a secondary school, you're like, oh, you little babe.
Yeah, it's such a weird transition. And also, the actual effect on your healthcare. I remember at Great Ormond Street, I was very much still a child at that point, and I was very much looked after by my consultant, and I've been really lucky to have amazing consultants that have always been really on the ball. But one thing that I did notice when I went to adult services and kind of facing the sort of long term of like, right, I'm going to be looked after by this hospital for the rest of my life and by these consultants across like my whole adulthood, and you're kind of faced with like, right, I'm actually managing this, and like I am the expert in my own healthcare. And I think that was the biggest lesson that I got from transitioning between those services, was being like, right, I've got to be on it, and I've got to remember when I've had this scan and when I've had these blood tests and that's something that Kim has been, brilliant at really instilling into Joel and I since we were really young, was trying to be really on top of your own healthcare, which, I think some people might be scared by that, because you go to a hospital and I think a lot of people go to the NHS and quite rightly expect to be looked after and to almost go, well, I'm not a professional, so this is your guys's job, and there is that to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But with care conditions, I think it's so important to kind of be your own expert on it. And Joel and I have both walked into so many rooms with healthcare professionals, and they've been like, "Oh, MEN, I've never heard of that." And
Yeah.
you know, at the start of your diagnosis, you're like, "What do you mean you've never heard of it? Like you guys are the doctors, you know? We're just some random people, you know." So you guys, we're coming
just
to you. And that was probably the biggest sort of lesson that I learned within my own, you know, management of my health was like, right, I've got to be my own advocate and my own expert in what I need, and to trust my own instinct about my body and listening to it and thinking, is there something wrong? Do I think there's something wrong? If I do, I've got to speak up and say something, because it's just better to be safe than polite.
And I completely get what you're saying about the, when people aren't used to using the healthcare system, they sort of go in and might think it's going to be one way, and then it's a bit of a shock when it's not. I've had a few forays into being the wrong side of the examination bed, and also been a young person in hospital. And I think from really early experiences, I've known to keep all of my records, because it's not that long ago that you didn't even have to have the patient CC'd on a letter or an email. It's not that long ago you didn't get your own results. And even now, like, it is, I think there's been a vast improvement. I think COVID has accelerated that. But it's very difficult to be in charge of your own care if you don't have your own data and your own information. And it's only been in the relative recent past that patients have been given their own records and data and things like that. Except for one place where I think we do this really well, because we recognise the need of the patient as a travelling person around who goes all sorts of places and might need help, and that's pregnancy.
Yeah.
Is the one time, and also now cancer, where you get given your information, you get given your notes, and you're meant to take it around everywhere with you.
Yeah.
And because that's, everyone knows that you're in a permanent state of sort of physiological change and things might happen. But, and the same goes for things like cancer. But actually, there's a whole lot of conditions that fall into that bucket that we don't necessarily do that with. And obviously, it's really great that Kim brought you both up to being charged that. And it's not that I think you shouldn't have to. I actually think being in control of your own information and understanding what's going on is really important. It's just that not everyone else has that guidance or has the, you know, has necessarily the resources or knowledge with how to do that. And I think that would be, I think one of the goals of that, basically, you know, Medics for Rare Diseases is making sure, people call it empowering patients. I don't think it's really necessarily empowering patients. It's just making sure that both the healthcare professional and patient are on the same page, get the same level of information, so that as they move around, as their condition changes, as people retire or whatever, the patient's information goes with them, that knowledge goes with them, and the next healthcare professional respects what they're bringing to them.
Yeah.
So you've got lots of things going on, young person and a singer-songwriting career, and yet you apply to be an ambassador for Magic Forever, which I just love. Why did you decide to apply? You can say your mum forced.
No, well, she made me aware of Medics for Rare Diseases, for sure. But I have always wanted to be a sort of active advocate for causes that I care about. So I was part of the Ivers Academy, which is a musicians collective, which stands for the rights of musicians and songwriters. And that was kind of a really valuable experience to me, to know what it's like to be part of a community and be able to sort of bring my experience as really, that was sort of as a young person in music and understanding everybody's rights and feeling like I had the power to change legislation, which has an effect on my career and young people's career. And I've always been a very sort of politically active person, so that was a way to sort of funnel that side of me into something actionable. So I really enjoyed that experience. And also, when I was a teenager, I used to volunteer for MEND, which is MEN's sort of main charity. And I really enjoyed doing that. So Medics for Rare Diseases was sort of, it was like, oh, that's perfect. That's the next thing I can hopefully add to and be helpful towards. And I haven't really in my sort of adult life been that active in the sort of rare disease charity sector. And I, you know, I am really inspired by my mum's work with her charity and, you know, being able to sort of do similar work I thought would be enjoyable and hopefully helpful to the medical world from my experience. So yeah, I was like, well, I'll just apply. They've probably got loads of people applying, but you know, I'll just do it and fingers crossed.
It was that and The Voice UK. So I'll apply for these two
It
things. Often people have those two things on their
was
bucket list next to each other.
fun.
And so yeah, well, you know, well, congratulations for making it onto the program. But no, I love it, and I'm liking that we don't, you know, we do these things, but you don't necessarily know how they're going to go. Something I'm really enjoying about the Ambassador Program is the number of young people who are joining, or people who, you know, they have a condition themselves, but they're not really into the condition specific group, not as a because it's a negative thing or anything, but it's just maybe not for them. And I like that we're sort of picking up people who don't necessarily otherwise have a platform, is the aim when it comes to those with lived experience. So, you know, we get a huge deal of support from the patient advocacy groups and people who've been in this industry or helped in this industry for a really long time. And I like the idea that we might be a bit of a gateway into the rare disease community, whether that's for healthcare professionals or people with lived experience. Yeah, it's going, I'm loving it. I'm loving the Ambassador Program. They're loving you. Do you, for GDPR reasons, we haven't got you on the WhatsApp group, but I know you've been a very busy lady. But I'll just read you some quotes from the WhatsApp group from the other night when you were on the telly box.
Oh my gosh.
Now, yeah, I know.
I'm very
Are you
bad at
bad
saying
at taking compliments?
compliments. I was just
Okay.
gonna say that now.
Right, let's have a go then, shall we? So we got someone said, "Go Hope, amazing, good luck, not that you need it. Isn't she amazing? How red can we make your cheeks go? Hope is amazing, absolutely watching and have everything crossed. I watched it, so inspiring, what an amazing voice and a beautiful woman. Wow, Hope, spectacular voice, new Insta fan right here. My goodness, she is talented. I have no, and then I hope that she won, so we weren't there yet. And then someone said, what an extreme honor as well to be sharing a stage with Hope at the Royal Society of Medicine.
Oh my gosh.
So, got loads of fans.
This is making me feel like a celeb now.
I love. Go on, tell us about your recent experience on The Voice UK.
Well, God, yeah. What an experience. I'm kind of still slightly in, I'm still processing it all. I still very much feel in the sort of aftermath of watching it all. But yeah, I'm so glad I did it. It was such a positive, fun experience. It was completely out of my comfort zone. And it was a weird thing, actually. It wasn't something I applied for. So they have like talent scouts, I guess. So they found me on Instagram and the woman was like, "Can I give you a ring? I just would love to ask you if you'd be up for being involved in something." And I was like,
Hold the phone. What were you like? You like what?
yeah, I thought, like, because basically my partner got scouted to be in first dates and dinner date before we were together. I thought I would have.
Is attractive man, is he? Or does
He
he look like someone who hasn't got a butt?
was, so I thought, oh my God, I wonder if it's that, I wonder if it's Love Island. And then I talked to her on the phone and she was like, "Yeah, so we're wanting to get sort of more singer-songwriters involved in The Voice, and we wondered if you'd be interested in, you know, making an application It basically fast tracks the application, I think, if you get scouted or whatever. So I had a little think about it, and I was sort of thinking in my career at that point, what was the best thing to do? And I just basically thought, well, I'll just go for it and see how it goes. I can't really, I've got nothing to lose. I had nothing to lose at that point. So I kind of thought, oh, I'll just go for it and see how it turns out. My only thing was like, I really do hope on the blind audition I do at least get a turn, because I am already a singer. So if there was no turns, that would be end of career.
Yeah.
So
So
I think
I'd watched a bit of The Voice before, but I didn't really do live TV in our house. So someone had told me, your mum, to watch The Voice, the first episode. So basically it's like nine or something like that. Anyway, episodes, right? And the first five or the first seven are blind auditions. Maybe it's seven episodes, but the first five are blind auditions. So the person's on the stage, and then you've got four well-known singing artists, like musical celebrities, and they're in these chairs, and you're stood there facing the back of these chairs because they're turned around, and you start to sing. And if they like your voice, they hit a big red button, and their chair spins around.
that's it. Yeah.
And like, did you literally just walk on the stage seeing some chairs turned around? Well,
Yeah,
tell me about it. Had you met
pretty
any
much.
of them beforehand,
No,
or?
so we don't meet any of them beforehand. We meet the band beforehand, and because I'm a musician and I'm, a musician fan, I actually knew of the members of the band because I was fans of them. But yeah, we get two band rehearsals. So we pick a song, you get two band rehearsals to sort of figure out the arrangement, figure out the key, and then you have a dress rehearsal in the studio, which the chairs don't turn around. You're just basically getting used to being on the stage. You have your sound set. So there are these big monitors in the stage where so you can hear yourself, and you get two goes at doing that, so you can't mess it up. And then you basically go back the next day. So it's sort of 3 days worth of being on set, if you like. And then the third day, all very long days. There's a lot of waiting around for things, which I've never been involved in TV before. So it was really cool seeing the side of like how big these crews are and all of the different elements of it. And they didn't, obviously they edit it in a different way, but in real life, I was the second person to audition out of the whole day,
Oh,
like
prime position.
out of yeah. So
Oh, how did that feel? How did that feel? Was it like, yes, they're going to be fresh, the judges, or they're not going to want to touch their buttons too early, as it were?
well, yeah, it was a mix, because I thought, well, I don't want to go last because they might have already used up all their spaces, because they were only allowed 10
Four? Okay.
spaces, or maybe it's
Hmm.
12. Yeah, so I thought, well, I don't want to be towards the end. But yeah, if I'm sort of towards the start, they might be a bit like, I might wait to see who else comes out. So I was very nervous. Like I'd had no idea. I didn't go in thinking, oh yeah, I've got this. This is a breeze. I was very much, I was really nervous. And it's also a completely different style of performing to what I'd done before. Doing it for TV is such a different experience.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, like, what's the difference? Like, how did it feel compared to gigging on a stage? I mean,
Yeah, it's really different, because I'm so used to on a stage, the audience are really close to me. I'm acting with them, I introduce myself, I talk to them. As much as that calms the audience, it calms me down as well. And then I'm ready to sing, and I'm a very chatty performer on stage normally as well. So it was kind of weird going just straight into singing without even introducing myself.
And basically a wall of red, the backs of red chairs.
Yeah, you're taught to connect with the audience and look them in the eye, and you learn all of these things from doing it. So it's so unnatural, kind of not even being able to read the reactions, which was so nice actually watching it back, being able to actually see the coaches react to how it was. But
The coach. So it's Anne Marie, Ollie Mears, Tom Jones, and will.i.am.
yes, and
Yeah.
yeah, and it was basically like the one of the crew just goes 3, 2, 1, on you go, and then you just do it, and you get one take. You can't redo it. And yeah, we don't meet the coaches before. We don't get told who to pick. I went on not knowing who I'd want to pick if they all turned around, which I was not counting on.
They did, audience. They all turned around. Anne Marie first, almost at the same time as Ollie Murs. So you went.
And then
So
Will
yeah.
did, and I was like, I really, basically towards the end of the song, I don't know if you can tell, but watching this back, I could tell. I basically was like, I really, now I've got three,
You want
I want
four.
a full house. I really tried at the end of that song to get Tom to turn, which he did, which was great.
Well done, Tom. So what? So you picked Ollie. You went for the team Mers.
I went for Team Mers, yeah, and that was basically all down to the pitches, really. Which again, they obviously have limited time in the episode, but the actual sort of post singing part was probably the longest bit of the audition.
Oh, really?
Where, yeah, it was really long. It was, I'd say, like maybe 20 minutes, where they were just asking about me and like asking about my career so far, and then they did their pitches. And to me, Ollie had the best pitch, and I was like, right,
Yeah.
we're doing it.
That's
And
he was so enthusiastic about you as well. And you see later on, like in the final, when he's like, you are the person I've wanted to win the most doing this. And I think you can really see the it's genuine.
yeah, I've been so lucky actually, because you never know going on these what celebrities are going to be like, I wasn't expecting anything from him apart from, what he was contracted to do.
It could be like the light touch, bare minimum.
But he really went above and beyond, and I consider him one of my friends now, and he was, I've learned so much from him as a performer. He's just excellent. I went and saw him at the O2 in the summer, and he's just a natural born performer, and I really learned a lot from him. And I played his wedding in the summer, which
Yeah,
was
I know. I think you can consider yourself friends. I don't think singing at his wedding was in his contract.
no,
So
I don't
no.
think it was. Yeah, I and that was something that literally I sort of said as a joke on one of the rehearsals, because he was obviously planning his wedding during the filming, so he was talking about it a lot. And I offhandedly was like, well, if you need a wedding singer, I'm available. And then literally on the final, at the end of filming, he was like, look, do you want to play our wedding, because we'd love to have you.
That's so nice. I've got a friend that Lauren Ray, singer-songwriter Lauren Ray, and we always get her out for weddings and funerals. In fact, at one of the last funerals she sang at, someone asked her if she was like a funeral gigger, and she was like, no, I just do funerals with my friends.
She's on the funeral circuit.
She's on
I
the
also
funeral
have the same
circuit.
thing.
She always declines a wedding. Love the beautiful.
There's a particular song on my YouTube that gets played a lot at funerals. So I think I'm actually also quite big on the funeral circuit. I'm not.
I think, hey, that's if there's a wish, then you've got a supply.
Yeah, I think I might need to bring out like the funeral album. Maybe
It's a
that'll
good you and El Ray could do a joint funeral venture. So tell me about the final, because I'm not gonna lie, I had basically assumed you were going to win. And I think it's awesome that you were a runner up, and it sounds like what you've got out of it is so much potentially more than what the win might have been. But what was it like on the night? And
It was amazing. It really did feel like how you imagine when you watch finals of things. I'm a big Bake Off fan. It the I can't only I can only describe the sort of the vibe between the contestants, like all the cast. Is so, to me, so similar to how Bake Off feels. Everyone was so supportive of each other. There was no off vibes. No one was competitive. No one was wishing each other anything but goodness.
Luck than good, yeah.
So that was really nice because to me, that really calms me down. If there was any sort of hint of people being,
Competitivity.
I would crumble. So it was just a really lovely vibe. It was incredibly quick. Well, it would be these bouts of like intensity and everything's happening, and then like a couple of hours waiting until your next performance, or an hour waiting to your next performance, and then nothing, waiting to the end of the show and waiting to hear the result. And obviously the costume changes are quite quick as well. Again, it's how I imagine almost like theatre probably is. It's going backstage, being really quick, having, getting changed, having a boob hanging out here and a leg hanging out there, and you're getting sewn in. And it was so much fun. I had so much fun. It was very overwhelming. The first performance that I did, I remember on the night, kind of not coming straight off stage and not even remembering really how it went, and then feeling kind of really weird that I hadn't remembered how I'd sung it. I'd sung it so many times, and you sing it once for the real thing, and I'm like, I can't remember actually what note was that, or was that the practice? And going backstage and getting changed and thinking, oh God, I don't know
What I did.
if that was good enough, or
I actually really understand that because I do the same spiel for medics for rare diseases over and over again. And sometimes you're just like, it's almost like you've driven to work and you can't remember, did I drive to work well? But it really matters when you're like trying to remember the details of, did I say that? And did I do this well? But
It was exactly that. Or like when you leave your house and you're like on autopilot, always lock the door, but is that one time the time that you didn't lock the door? And it felt like that, and that felt really difficult at the time because I was getting ready for the next performance, which was the big one with Ollie, which was, amazing to do. And also watching it back again, what I really liked about it was that I really looked like I was enjoying myself, and I was enjoying
You
myself, but sometimes
did,
it doesn't always translate to my face, like especially when I'm performing. I think sometimes I can look quite serious, and
I've
inside
got resting miserable
I'm
face, so
yeah I think I do, like when I especially when I'm performing, I think because I'm taking it so seriously and I'm really into what I'm doing, it sometimes comes across like a little bit serious. And what I loved about watching it, and I think it's because I was partly interacting with a stage partner, which was really
Really
helpful.
nice, yeah. And that it, chemistry again was genuine, it was real.
And that was so nice. Like he's a very like collaborative and generous performer to perform with. Like you can perform with some people and they just don't give you anything. And it's such subtle things. It's like just body language and like facial language that's completely sort of subconscious to what is going on from what you're singing.
I feel like most of this is basically describing what it's like to be in hospital, like lots of waiting around, random moments of
Random
high
moments of
activity,
flurrying.
leg here, body there, boob there, like changing, and then lots of waiting around again, and then you can have a doctor, and it's just those it's those subtle facial things. It's the way someone behaves or leans towards you, or way they involve you. That's what makes the difference in a consultation. I feel like it's quite similar to a day in hospital at an MDG or something.
Except I would say I wish that you got a whole audience clapping you once you'd come out of surgery or something. Very
You can rent an M4RD audience for another hospital
lovely.
eventually.
That stitch was just brilliant. Amazing.
Beautiful.
So it was so weird, and sort of watching it back as well, you're sort of experiencing it all over again because it's such a quick moment. It's a day, and it was pre-recorded, so it was sort of bringing it all back watching. And also I was like, I hadn't seen any of it, so I didn't know what I looked like or like how it would come across on camera. And as much as I obviously am in front of cameras quite a lot, I was probably most nervous about like how I looked, which is so
I like.
it should just be about what I sounded like, but I was
No, of
nervous
course you.
about.
No, of course you. I liked the bit where you were in the final and Ollie was talking to you and your family, and oh, your brother Joel,
Oh
and he
God.
was like, oh, it's great to see her have her sparkle back or something. I was like, oh, God, I'm gonna cry. And then it's pans to you, no offense, and you're like crying, crying. And then you're like, I'm crying because I'm happy. Like, that is literally me. That is, and that is how I express happiness, is through just tears rolling
I
down my
know.
face.
I was honestly, I really wanted to go on, not that I have anything against it, but I really didn't want to cry throughout any of the filming, just because. And after the first audition, there's a moment where I kind of catch myself because I can feel myself emotional, and it's not because I didn't want to show that emotion. I just felt like I wanted to keep it professional, and I'm a bit of a private crier. So when we
Not
were doing
anymore.
that, not anymore. I know. It's oh God, yeah. But it on that particular filming day, and they'd surprised me with them all coming along. My brother lives quite far away, so I don't get to see him as much as I would like to. So they surprised me by coming, and then we basically had this sort of hour-long conversation about my entire career since I've been like since I was 13, and like my family saying that they were really proud of me and supporting me through all my ups and downs, because music is a hard career to sort of with and persevere with. And I've had amazing opportunities, but I've also had times where I've been like, is this worth it? Am I doing the right thing? And so it was all of the last 10 years of like all the hardship and all the passion that I've put
Then
in,
then with cameras
and
and all
with
the
cameras.
mirrors when you
My sister
behave.
in law she started crying, and then I was like, well, if you've started now, I'm going to, because I'm such a reactive crier as well. If somebody else cries, I'll cry.
I think you would, I think it would have been quite an effort not to. And I think I wanted to come on to some of the real impact that I think you've made of setting your narrative at the beginning. When you, in the first episode, if anyone can go back and watch anything, the first episode when both yourself and your brother talk about MEN and living with MEN, and that's the way you approach it, is your hope. You are hope, you do all of these things. You also manage a rare con you live with a rare condition, and you're managing some tumors at the moment. And I just think, thank you. Wow, what an amazing representation of someone young living with a rare condition, but doing their thing that we don't often get. And that you weren't crying at. This is your life. You're in control. You're doing what you want to do. I think it's absolutely amazing, though, at the end, you'd have to be made of rock to not cry when you, after everything, you must have been so tired and surprised and everyone saying nice things. But,
No, thank
and
you.
it's not that you have to be, you don't, just because we don't want something to be like the sympathy vote, and we don't want it to be, it doesn't mean we have to take all the emotion out of it. It's about it being the genuine place for it, and for you, that's in that praise at the end and that reflection. And
Yeah.
yeah, I really, anyone who's listening, if you can watch episode one and the last episode and watch Hope, I think there's a really great standard of television in there when we're approaching chronic conditions that isn't usually there, thanks to
Yeah.
you.
Thank you. That really means a lot, because I think that was always something that I knew was going to come up, because I had to write it in my medical form. So obviously they were gonna, if I hadn't brought it up, they would have been like, well, what's this? And I was really conscious that I didn't want it to be that traditional reality TV sob story, because also to me that felt like it wouldn't even be doing my experience of it justice, because again, it's not this one-off tragic event. It's like a lifelong, it is a difficult thing to deal with, but it's also a part of me, a part of my life, and a part of the reason why I do music as well. So it is very relevant to me being a singer, and why I've chosen to do the career that I do, and why I fell in love with it in the first place. And what I did spend quite a long time on was thinking about the language that I used around it to present it. So I know we talked about before, you know, me saying that I manage a rare condition, I don't suffer from it, I don't, you know, I haven't been.
You're not affected, you're
Yeah,
not, yeah.
I manage it myself. I'm in control of it, and that helps me feel like I am a bit in control of it, even though it is a really unpredictable condition, as many rare diseases are. It felt like I was taking control of that narrative, and it wasn't something that, you know, I didn't want it to have this really heavy feeling towards talking about it. I wanted it to be a part of my biography and who I am, but it's not the be all and end all of who I am as a person and as a professional. You know, it's something that I live with, and that's fine. And I hope that that's a way that it could be presented that would help other people. And I had some really lovely messages from more people than I knew that had MEN and live with MEN, saying thank you so much for, you know, shedding light on it and bringing it up, which for me personally was so lovely to even know that all of these people live with MEN. Because I think sometimes it feels like you've got one person with MEN here, and then another person in a random part of the country that has it. And it was just so lovely to sort of be able to shed light on a really small community, but it felt like everyone was coming together, and also adding a bit of adding a bit of lightheartedness to it. You know, it can feel, in some ways, I feel like rare diseases can be presented as quite an unglamorous thing. And I like to think of myself as a glamorous person. And
I'm looking at you right now. For anyone who hasn't seen Hope and is just listening on podcast, you are 100% glamorous.
I didn't, you know, I think rare diseases can be sexy. I think you know, it's a fun thing to think about how we portray our own healthcare. It doesn't always have to be this sort of unglamorous.
Optimization. What we're facing is this idea of like men's health and optimization. And if I wear this watch and I eat this many calories at this point, and then I do 2 seconds of exercise, and then I still like as if there's like some kind of optimal being. It's almost where we've got this really bizarre situation where anything that requires healthcare is seen as a really bad state of affairs, rather than just bodies being bodies. Does that make sense?
I think that's so true. And one of the things that I've also been reminded of being an ambassador for M4RD is how common rare conditions are. You know, rare conditions are rare, but rare conditions as a whole are common. And human bodies aren't perfect, and everybody in their lifetime will experience a blip in whatever part of their health that may be. And that's normal and natural, and, you know, actually I think quite nice, because, you know, people can connect with other people that are dealing with difficult things. And actually that's what makes us all human, the fact that we have imperfect bodies and imperfect lives, and I think there's nothing more human than that.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much, Hope. And I love that you are out there as an example, because not everyone wants to do advocacy or can, or it's just not their thing, and that's absolutely fine. But it's great also to have examples of people where they're representing a different group. We know these days much more than ever that representation matters, and you're a young woman living with an invisible rare condition, managing it, taking control of it, and also just doing so much more. It's just one piece of your pie chart that makes up Hope Russell Winter, and I think that's what you get to see on the show. On that note, you'll be coming to our annual symposium, which is on February the 21st, the Unusual Suspects, Rare Disease and Everyday Medicine. And we're talking about communication this time, and how I think partly the work that I did with Rare Minds, how really language is the most important and basic tool that we have, and how we use that how that can really impact for the better or for the worse. And we've got a panel with yourself and two other people who live with a rare condition and a someone who identifies as a carer of someone with a rare condition, talking about the impact of language. But that doesn't just mean words, it means behavior, the way people approach you. So hopefully this is just the start of combining a amazing music career and an advocacy career. But is there anything that any messages that you would like to put out to our audience at this point, or anything you kind of, it doesn't have to be rare disease related really, like it could be anything that you've sort of learned with the big year you've just had?
That's a very good question. I think I can only speak from my experience, and hopefully that's helpful for other people to relate to. But I feel like my experience after being on the show and my sort of mantra for last year was just trying to be as comfortable and at home with myself as a person. And once I got to that point, that's what made me feel like I could speak from a very healthy and happy place. And managing things like a rare condition, it can just feel sometimes so overwhelming, and it does sometimes feel like that is all you are, and it eats you up, and you just feel so frustrated and annoyed at the fact that you're having to manage something that most people don't have to manage, and that's annoying. But I think health is a long-term relationship with yourself also, and it can chop and change, and it's a very hard thing to get to a place where you feel like, right, this is what I'm dealing with, and this is my lot, and I'm actually gonna decide that I can make the most of this. And I feel like I'm being not very articulate right now.
No, you are. No, you are. I understand that that's true acceptance of
Yeah.
yourself.
I think that would be my main message from last year was acceptance, and also the confidence to be able to feel like I am qualified enough to speak about my experience to other people, because I live with a rare condition, and that's what other people with rare conditions can think about too. And also connecting with people from that community is really, really helpful. Like when I first got diagnosed with MEN, finding Amend was something that was just so invaluable to me as a sort of newly diagnosed person. I felt like we were the only two people in the world to have this rare condition. And that in itself felt really overwhelming and scary, because it felt like, oh my God, if we're the only two, then how are we going to ever be able to be looked after or look after ourselves? And it was in finding a community of people that had MEN and other rare conditions that made me feel so much safer and more understood by other people. So that would be the other thing I would say, is connecting
Connections.
communities. Yeah, because I think that's something that's actually really difficult to find nowadays. I think maybe like 100 years ago, we were communities to find were such a given, when people would go to church, or technology wasn't a factor, so we were all forced to talk to each other in person. And I think that's something that is really important today, is to try and find those communities and friends and other people that are similar to you, and sticking to them.
I think the connectivity within the rare disease world is really important, and I think it's true for a lot of those kind of hidden, those hidden difficulties that everyone carries. I think it's the same with grief, just it I think it, you come across someone who has also lost someone close to them, and once you find, I find this, once I find out, I feel like I can sort of relax a little if I'm talking to them. There's they that kind of Not everyone therefore is appropriate, or it doesn't mean you're like best friends, or but there's that kind of, oh, you kind of might get some of the things that I'm now going to talk about, or
Standing there of that experience, that
yeah
think, I don't know if everyone feels this way, but I always feel so much better after a really good chat with the right person.
No, definitely. I won't take up too much more of your time, but I do want to know, is there anything that we should we be following? We need to follow Hope Winter Music.
Hope
Hope.
Winter Music, yeah. I am Hope Winter Music on everything, and I have a link in the description on my Instagram, which you can sign up to my newsletter and find my music and all things like that from my Instagram. And I also have a show. It's not been announced yet, but it might be by the time this has come out on the 7th of March, which is my
Okay.
next headline show at The Social in London, and
Booking
tickets
tickets
on
as soon
sale.
as I can.
Thank you.
Oh, amazing. Okay, 7th of March. Everyone, see you there. And we'll find out about that via your newsletter, which we're going to sign up to via your Instagram account, the link at the top, which is Hope Winter Music. You could also check out Hope chatting with other great people at the Unusual Suspects at the Royal Society of Medicine on the 21st of February. It's both online and in the person, so plenty of opportunities. And hopefully this is just the start of seeing lots of you, both in advocacy, but really, really importantly, out there becoming a superstar.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you for
Is
having me.
Yeah, and also, we've got to give a big shout out to Kim and Joel and
Yes.
Joel's wife, who I feel like I know Joel and Joel's wife between like chatting between you and your mum, but
Yes.
the support crew.
Yeah, they did so well on the show as well. You know,
Yeah.
the three of them, they're not people that I think. Well, who is used to being on TV? And they just did so well, and they went above and beyond for me as well. There were so many filming days that they had to go to that were so long. And, Joel did so, Joel had to basically be partly the sort of MEN rare disease, guy, informer to the public, talking
Yeah.
about his own experience. And he worded it so well, and he
Yeah.
did so well talking about it.
Yeah.
So yeah,
Well.
he did it, and he has so many admirers now. So at least he got
Oh. So how do we follow Joel?
out how to do it. He has a private account, and they've still found him.
Oh, slipping into his DMs.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Gonna get
Yeah.
him as an ambassador. That will really help our reach.
Yeah.
And we normally end we end the podcast by asking you to choose a song to go on our Rare Disease Discs playlist, which is available on Spotify. And
Oh,
then
yes.
usually what happens is I try to sing that song because we obviously don't have any licensing rights to play it. But have you chosen a song?
So I have a song in mind that, so it's not one of my songs, I will say
Okay.
that. It's a song that I am a fan of, but I listened to this song when I first heard this song. It made me feel like it's one of those ones that gives you just a lovely self-confidence vibe. Maybe when you're feeling a bit like, oh, I'm just really struggling with how I'm
Yeah.
feeling at the moment. It just makes me feel bougie
P
and
picks
lovely.
you up a bit. Oh,
It
yeah.
does. So
Okay.
it's by Gregory Porter, who I think
Yeah.
has one of the most sexiest
Yeah.
voices alive, and it's called Everything You Touch Is Gold. It's an amazing song. I love it. I
Are
don't
you gonna give us? Are you gonna? Are you give a give the crowd what they want?
I can't do it justice. I'll have to tell everybody to listen to his version, because it is
Okay,
just
listen to his version. Because
it's
obviously, if I could sing it right now, I would do it justice. Have you need to
it's
go back and listen to the other podcast recordings and see what how I hacked those up. I'm sure you could do it justice. Do you think we could hope for a Gregory Porter, Hope Russell Winter duet one day?
I am manifesting that. That would be
I am too now. I was actually looking for something to manifest.
Yeah.
I haven't got anything at the moment, so
Man, manifest that, please.
I'll
Yeah,
put it
pop
on my
that on the
manifest
list.
queue. Yeah. Okay. I'll get my people to call his people.
Thank you. I
Sorted.
appreciate it.
Well, Hope, thank you so much for coming on this one-off special. I'm sure that everyone listening can agree it was absolutely appropriate given that we are in 2024, which is a very exciting year. And you've got a very exciting year ahead after achieving so much last year and just being a great representative for this community and giving so much already. So it's an absolute pleasure to have had the chance to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
No problem. And Ollie Mers, if you're listening, can you tag us and follow us and everything? Thank you. Thank you. I'm available for weddings. Oh, wait, I'm available for funerals.
A word
Yeah,
in.
do. Yeah. All right. Bye.
Bye.